I was asked to moderate this. My name is Eglinton. This is Dr. Don Florey, most of you know, Dr. Al Burlingame, and Dr. Cyril Ponnam-Perumah. I think we may as well keep it short and briefly say something, each of us, and then throw it open to hear what really controversial points have come up in the course of this morning. I scribbled a few notes down here, and the first thing is we have a consensus that nothing alive was found, nothing that looked alive was found or had been alive at one time. No compounds were extracted which anyone was prepared to say were indigenous and were of biolipid type. We then come to the point, what does one make of the carbon compounds that are there, and what form is the carbon in, where did it come from, and so on. Now, this means that the whole pattern of the plan of attack on the organic geochemistry of the moon is now open for complete change in experimental techniques and approach. There are people, no doubt, who would now feel that their type of compound is not there, therefore they are no longer interested. There are others who probably feel now that there's a new type of work they could do, they're already working in another field and now want to come in and see what they can make of it. So the points that come to me are first that the methods that we now use to attack this problem are probably going to be very different from those that we had set up to tackle it, not knowing at all what we were likely to find. And this brings to the question of site, of where the compounds are, which I personally think is important. And secondly, the methods that can be used to detect compounds in particular sites. The next point is that of sampling. The comparison to be made between the lunar materials themselves and also with, of course, the meteorite samples. But for once, we really do have the opportunity to obtain contamination-free samples of an extraterrestrial body, which will probably be denied to us for a long time with meteorites. There is also some connection with the chemistry of the sun, which has to be looked at. And finally, from all of this, one realizes that the contamination problem is still at the heart of things. This is evident from the discussions this morning. And obviously, some of the techniques that are used have to be designed not really to look for the indigenous material, but to look for the contamination and then advise NASA on how this can be got rid of in future flights and so on. Well, I think that each person here has some different expertise and approach which would reflect on some of these problems. I think particularly that Dr. Florey might like to tell you a little of what he hopes might be achieved at the LRL in the way of increased cleanliness of samples for 12 and for later flights. Maybe you'd like to say something about that.
Well, I think I'd just like to make an observation about the results that were given this morning. It seems to be pretty obvious to me that there's unfortunately, we didn't uniformly contaminate the sample, and it seems to be some types of contamination in one investigator's sample that doesn't appear to be present in another. I think if you recall back to the PET article on the Apollo 11 preliminary organic analysis results, comment was made that the amount of indigenous organic material was obviously very small, and the amounts of contamination that were introduced in those handling procedures seemed to be quite large, so trying to make much sense of it was going to be very difficult, and obviously that's what has come about. As far as improvements in handling procedures in the lunar receiving laboratory, I think we have been much more conscientious across the board. Maybe in Apollo 11 there's not a general feeling and attempt to eliminate these problems as there has been in 12. It's much, much improved, and there are many people there we have to thank for that assistance. I think I'll leave it to Al to tell you about the results of the samples, monitors, and so forth that we have run in the Apollo 12 sample survey, which I think tells very much the story of how better a job we're doing there.
Yeah, thank you, Don. This is indeed an interesting occasion. I'd like to say something controversial to begin with, which I think has come out of the past year's activities from my point of view. And I'd like to suggest a different point of view with respect to what we know about organic matter from extraterrestrial sources at this point. And I'd like to suggest that carbonaceous chondrites even might be misnamed, at least type 3 carbonaceous chondrites. From the week's discussions, we heard from Professor Anders on Monday that one might imagine that 2% of the lunar material is contaminated with respect to the moon from carbonaceous chondrites. Of course, we don't see any evidence of this material in the lunar sample. Two points of view might be taken. One might be that one might expect, if there is no significant indigenous organic matter to the moon, that we would find all of this organic matter which we've always been finding and thought were in carbonaceous chondrites. Maybe one should take the hypothesis that there is no organic matter, at least no, maybe not organic matter. There's certainly carbon. Maybe there are aromatic hydrocarbons. Maybe there are small molecules like carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and products, small products of something which might have been synthesized in the solar nebula, which has been suggested, or in other ways from various energy sources, but that the amount of carbon-carbon bonded material from these samples might be very low indeed. It's just a thought, and maybe a different point of view which will help us focus in on what our real problems are. I think that a general comment or conclusion could be drawn that over the past year, we've become infinitely more careful in our investigations than we were before. And I think, at least speaking for our own laboratory, this was first pointed out so dramatically to me in the Pueblito del Ende meteorite, which picked up a couple of parts per million of terrestrial contamination in the dry desert in 7 days. This got us very worried about procedures all the way from the rock box which went to the moon to the lunar receiving laboratory vacuum systems and handling procedures, that we were really dealing, or really could be dealing, with a very low amount of carbon in any form in the return lunar samples. And this, unfortunately, in these samples has turned out to be even worse by orders of magnitude than I think we realized in our planning a couple of years ago. To bring the conversation more current, I think it was adequately pointed out quite early in the game that contamination would be a major problem in Apollo 11, and strenuous efforts were made to clean it up. And I think that considering the state of things last March, the people at MSC did a rather amazing job at getting it down to the levels that we're talking about, whether we're arguing about 40 parts per million on the one hand as an outside number, say, or 10 parts per billion or something on the other side, is essentially a moot point, I think, at this particular stage. But the point is that it got down from really very large amounts of whether you can tell is butter in your butter dish, so to speak, to something which is in a very low range. From our experiment in the Apollo 12 samples in the past couple of months, we've seen that changes in the handling procedure over Apollo 11 have resulted in lowering the levels of contamination by, again, maybe at least a factor of 10, if not a factor of 100 or more. And the largest numbers that we see with the so-called B-squared experiments are 1 part per million. And they range down to something like 100 parts per billion. So I think that maybe at this point we should all go back home and read over everybody else's manuscript and our own manuscript and take a good hard look at what we did, what other people did, and see whether or not, I would predict that after the results of Apollo 12, at least as far as the lunar Mare are concerned, that the situation will be indeed very clear and that there will be probably only small molecules found which can be somehow related to the solar wind and to other processes. I would be really excited, I guess, if we can come up with something that would be indicative of this indication that carbonaceous chondrites might contaminate the moon. I think I've talked long enough. Thank you.
I'd like to take off from where I'll stop. I think none of us are here simply for the fun of trying to squeeze out the last molecule out of these rocks. You know, we are all here to try and get some answers to fundamental questions. So our attitude should be, as a body of principal investigators and co-investigators, what can we do to influence the people who are providing us with the samples to get better samples for us? It became very clear in the course of our analysis that one could pick up an oceanic basalt or something like that as a dry run in the laboratory and come up with about one part per million of organic matter on the Earth. So on that basis, one would say then there's no point in looking for further organics. So what we should be after in future missions, I don't know how much we can influence Apollo 13, is to try and see whether better samples suited for the organic PIs could be obtained. I think it is unrealistic to expect any carbon-carbon bonds to survive a long period of time in the first couple of centimeters or so of the lunar surface. And rather than just say, adopt a defeated attitude and say, well, we'll try to find out how much the surface of the moon is being enriched by solar bombardment, I think we should try and do something perhaps through LSAP to try and influence the sampling on the next occasion. And maybe something better than just CO might be in store for us.
Could I make one more comment before? I'd like to clear up a couple of points which I forgot to mention. One has to do with the preliminary analysis and this high of one part per million. The procedures which were used were changed over Apollo 11 in that heat sterilization to 130 degrees for 30 hours was used to get the samples out of the bioprep area, which was quite clean, rather than ethylene oxide them out or dunk tank them out with peracetic acid, which we had very bad experiences with on Apollo 11. And these, when the quarantine barrier goes down, which I guess was yesterday afternoon, sometime later this week, we intend to rerun the subsurface samples to see whether we still get a value which is as high as one part per million or maybe something higher in the core tube samples and the finds which were taken from the subsurface material. Since they were all exposed to this 130 degrees for 30 hours, there's some question as to whether or not there could be more material or whether we've lost some or so on and so forth. I just wanted to clear that up.
Just before we open it to the firing from the floor, Don Flory has one point here which I think is of value to everybody, and that is he proposes to give you a very brief account from the from this sort of interest point of view on the E12 sample. So we're going to have to do that.
Well, first of all, we have two samples that have been set aside for organic analysis. One of these is what has been sometimes referred to as the prime organic sample, and it's in this special sealed, I think they call it special environmental sample container. And as far as I know, I think it's something like 5 to 100 grams or something like that in there. Is that right, Don Morrison? 300 grams. That material is now sealed in its original container, has never been opened in a lunar receiving lab. Then we have a core tube, likewise in its original container, which probably amounts to something like 100 grams. That material is available, having never been handled in the lunar receiving lab, and yes, it's core taken from the trench, so it may very well represent material from greater depth than the double core tube, which the samples that Al is talking about that we probably will look at sometime later this week. I think it's pertinent to point out that these are the two samples that we have that have not been exposed at all in the lunar receiving lab. Then we have the material that's been processed in the F201 vacuum chamber, some fines material that's been also set aside, a portion of it as an organic reserve sample. And we have material that's been processed in the bioprep cabinet, the nitrogen processing line. A little bit about processing in the nitrogen cabinet this time, I think there was a much less potential for organic contamination than in Apollo 11. So essentially, it's my feeling that all the material that is in that cabinet is a worthwhile candidate for our type of work. Then I would like to say that as far as the future handling of this special core tube and this prime organic sample, I think we ought to take a lot of time in determining where, when, and how we would open those containers and distribute that material. And I think that's a thing we could very well like to have comments from you all.
I can see a lot of people with questions. Perhaps the gentleman with the microphone would select from this general area.
Right, thank you. John Hayes. I just wanted to ask, in the lunar catalog, or the Apollo 11 sample catalog, the B-squared experiment spectra kept subtracting some of the molecules that we've heard about with sort of the most interest today, namely peaks at 16, 15, 14, 13, and peaks at 28, which would have been carbon monoxide. Is there a constant background of these things in the LRL? And if so, are we kidding ourselves again? Or what is the story on that?
Well, as far as I remember, and Smith can correct me if I'm wrong, we do see large amounts of carbon dioxide. You must realize that having the level of the background down a couple of orders of magnitude has cleared up the experiment from our point of view tremendously. And now we do see large amounts of carbon dioxide, and I don't know, do we see carbon monoxide also? Dennis? Yeah, okay, so it's unresolved from nitrogen, but does the ratio of nitrogen dioxide, oxygen, is that equivalent to atmospheric ratios? Or I don't know, I'm just asking you to guess. Klaus? Sure.
I think the picture is getting slanted now. Everybody talks about carbon and carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. Now, it should be kept in mind that that experiment was to look for levels of organic material, and I don't think anybody in this room will call carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide an organic compound. And that is the thing which drives the numbers, the non-organic carbon numbers higher. And on purpose, if one would always include the signal for CO2, I mean, everything else would be in the noise level. So that's the reason for removing it. But it's not an organic compound.
Dennis Smith, the 16, 17, and 18 are specifically subtracted because of the tremendous amount of water that the lunar sample seems to be picked up, exposed to the atmosphere.
But as before, I mean, all of this data is in the sample catalog, both the deleted total ion current and also the plotted total ion current. So, you know, those kind of questions can easily be resolved.
The Cotton Moore results are still acceptable based on your comments, then, because I mean we have heard various comments here that we're only dealing with a few parts per million of organic materials. So the Cotton Moore results are dealing in terms of a few, let's say 200 parts per million, would be basically caused by carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, maybe?
Carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, graphite, anything.
Carbide. We seem to be very much getting involved with one idea here, that the carbon in the lunar sample is coming from the solar wind. Now, I see the Professor Urey here. I wonder if he would care to comment. But can we get that much carbon in the lunar samples from the solar wind? So Jerry Wasserberg made some comment on Monday that he thought it was impossible. Yeah.
Now, other people I've talked to in the past couple of days think it's quite within the range of possibilities to get that much carbon from the solar wind. I think the reason we keep talking about the solar wind now is if the sample has all been formed from a melt at 2,000 degrees, that indigenous material, if it were there, is probably very likely either very low or gone, and it's been replaced from the by the solar wind, possibly.
I'd like to make another suggestion again. I mentioned this earlier last year. One runs very easily into this problem of very low concentrations. And what is being done now is that people get 10, maybe 20 grams of material. Don't you think at some point in the future, not Apollo 12, but maybe 13 or 14 or somewhere along the line, we could get kilogram amounts of material that would be processed such that the fractions would be done, say, here at MSC, and then the individual solvent fractions sent out to the principal investigators for that individual fraction. Because, you see, you might be able to get concentrations that are, in this way, three orders of magnitude and more than what we have now. And we are basically, again, in the problem that we had with the carbonaceous chondrites. I really wonder whether one shouldn't think about this.
And if I could just say something here. Of course, the interest within the scientific community extends so widely that to argue the case for a particular group of investigators is a constant effort, put it mildly. The proposition you have put forward has been put forward on several occasions that one should make a large sample for this sort of reason. However, I think with the results we now have, I think that, as Burlingame says, one should sit back somewhat and survey what has been done, try to identify the problems very carefully, and do very sensitive work on the sort of size of sample that we've been getting in 11 for... certainly for 12 and probably for 13, and at some point it may then be reasonable, I think, to argue the case for such a, what is effectively an extremely expensive request. But it may be necessary.
I'd like to take up the problem of the solar wind to some extent. Excuse me. I'd just like to know what other possible source there is in view of the observations that have been made. For one thing, everyone agrees that the rare gases appear to have a solar source. Now, unless for some reason the rare gases are overabundant in the solar wind and the carbon is underabundant in the solar wind, Carlton Moore has put forward calculations which I think demonstrate fairly reasonably that a good fraction of the carbon could certainly have come from the solar wind. If we consider, in addition, his result, that carbon seems to be most abundant in the fine particles, and therefore it becomes what Dieter Heymann called a surface area related thing. In other words, it's something which appears to be coming in through the surface area, through the surface of the grains, as a solar wind type product would. Then it seems reasonable to say that most of the carbon could be indeed from the solar wind. An alternate source might be 2% of carbonaceous chondrites, but I suppose that in the process of impacting, the carbon would be lost. When Ed Anders proposed the type 1 carbonaceous chondrite addition, he didn't really mean to say that he thought type 1 carbonaceous chondrites as such hit and gave rise to this material. I think his interpretation would be that this could have been at some early stage in the condensation of the nebula, and it might not have carried carbon with it at that time. And I really think that thinking along these lines and trying to think of an alternate source is going to be rather productive. I mean, if it's not from the solar wind, let's hear what the other suggestions are and to try to evaluate the evidence that we have and see how those ideas fit and what we would think of doing after that.
I hope these comments are being recorded because I want to go on record with a statement as to my utter disillusionment and disappointment with this whole group of papers, with very few exceptions. My name is Breger. Some of you probably know that last March I wrote a blast to NASA regarding the proposals for the analysis of this sample. I don't know what happened to my blast, but apparently it was based on good premises, because the failure to come up with proper results using the samples that have been used indicates primarily that they have been wasted. Now, I can't say much about the solar wind. It's too theoretical. I don't know where the carbon comes from, and I'm not prepared to discuss that. But I am prepared to ask a specific question, and that is, how many people who presented papers and worked on these samples set out to find what the forms of carbon were in the samples they had available and found out what the forms of carbon were? And if you go down through the list of abstracts, you will find that you can take all your mass spectroscopic results and record them as a list of raw data showing fragments with positive charges, which has no bearing whatsoever on the basic material present in the sample. And if you were to do this time after time after time, you would come up with exactly the same answer, zero. It will give you no basis in fact. The second thing I would like to point out is that nearly every paper that's been given, it appears that the individuals working with the samples came up with the situation, the same situation, namely that there is very little extractable or readily isolatable material bearing carbon. And so subsequently, what can you do? You have to have a paper to report on for all the thousands of dollars that have been expended. And so you do something else. And as a result, we heard today a great deal of work regarding sulfur in these samples and other components of these samples, but again, very little regarding the actual means by which the carbon is retained in these samples. Now, what I say is this. It's time that we started sorting out the experimental work that has been done on the 11 samples and discarding those experiments that are obviously useless, because to repeat them is to repeat the waste, both in money and sample, and to get down to the basic experiments which have a chance of telling us what the forms of carbon are in the sample, either Apollo 11, because we certainly don't know that yet, and the subsequent Apollo samples that we will be working with. And I, therefore, beg that the people at NASA look this over very carefully, because if they don't, someone up above will pretty soon. It can't be hidden. There's very little coming out of this, and we've got to make a decision here so that those who perhaps have more and better experimental techniques can use them to achieve a result, namely to find out what the forms of carbon are. As far as I know, only one group or two groups have attempted this and come up with reasonable answers, and the answers are far from complete. And let me make one further pitch. If we don't have enough sample to do it right, don't do it at all. And there's no answer to this. There's no alternative to this. If you don't have enough to do the sample right, to get the answers, don't attempt it, because you'll only end up with something which is confusing. Confuse you and confuse everybody else. And the second pitch I'd like to make is this. If we can't get enough sample out of the committees responsible for this, by God, we need powerful people.
Jedward from Brussels. As you know, perhaps, I tried to find some contribution of carbonaceous meteorites in the lunar soil. not from the organic part, but from the magnetite part. Quantities of magnetite determined are range from 10 to 25% by weight. So if there is a contribution of 1 or 2% carbonaceous meteorites, we have to find 0.1% magnetite. And as you know, there is no one grain of magnetite be found in the kilograms of samples. I was told by the impact man that the less dense a material is, the most volatile it becomes during impact. And so you have three chances to retain metallic meteorites and no chance to have silicate meteorites. So I think the same must be happening to carbonaceous material too. Another point is that I have observed some graphitic-like or coal-like particles, and I don't dare to play my reputation by quoting this. I suppressed this from my paper, but I think it's worth to be extracted from the hell. Arrhenius, who is a good observer, has found some graphitic-like particles in his soil. So I think it would be very helpful if NASA could establish some kind of procedure to concentrate graphitic-like or coal-like particles by HF or density centrifugation, and to begin a good microscopical and chemical and electron microscopical work on these possible particles, which may exist, perhaps not in great quantity, but they seem to exist at least at a low level.
I think at least one of the speakers of this morning has to make a comment about Dr. Brigger's comment. I think it is important that this morning's papers were related to the problem of organic compounds present in the lunar sample. And one has to, I think, what got lost, and I think that was what I wanted to point out before, that people are confusing carbon as such with organic compounds. And I must say, I personally am just not interested whether the carbon is there as carbon, as graphite, or as diamonds, or as this or that. that is someone else's problem and interest. And it is very easy afterwards to say, oh, you didn't find anything because nothing was there, so why did you ever look for it? There have been statements made that the moon might be a carbonaceous chondrite by eminent scientists, half perhaps tongue-in-cheek, but it certainly there were many, many different theories hanging around before what could be on the moon, and one just had to look for it. I at one time called it a scientific charity to look for organic compounds on the moon, but frankly, it has to be done. So if this morning's results were sometimes not very exciting, then that's really not our fault, but one had to look for it, and one still has to look for it, and I perfectly agree that one has to look for in which form the carbon, and in that respect, I would even put the nitrogen in the same category, in which form is carbon and nitrogen there, and to which extent is it related to, might it have carbon-carbon bonds or carbon-nitrogen bonds, which then come close to the structure of organic compounds. But the total, that's a very vast amount of carbon, I mean, the vast fraction of the carbon that is there is non-organic, I think it's by now clear, and probably was never assumed to be organic at the outset.
Yes, I think I'd like to say something about that point. I think any of us, and I'm sure you probably have too, who have dealt with macromolecules and pyrolyzed them, aware of the fact that depending upon the conditions of pyrolysis, and I could probably sit down and write down 10 or 15 parameters offhand, we can get almost any products we desire. Beside this particular point, the problem is the biggest problem that we have with this kind of work, as I see it, is in relating the fragments back to the original organic material, assuming that there is organic material present. I haven't said there is. My point, and the point I try to make, perhaps got lost too, is that if you do this mass spectroscopy in an effort to find the organic material that's present, and you end up with a catalog of ionic fragments, how in hell are you going to get it back on the basis of the material from which those fragments arose? I defy you to do this. And if you can't do this, then you end up with a catalog of ionic fragments having little more significance than a page in a journal.
If I could make a comment here, I'm delighted to have this fierce attack from Dr. Breger. The situation, I think, the situation is now much clearer, simply because of the work that's been done during the last few months. I would say that it's imperative that some people get into this part of the program who know something about the forms of carbon that can occur in a mineral matrix. Why don't they apply to the NASA authorities? As far as LESAPT is concerned, we can only deal with proposals that have been passed and the samples asked for distribution. I would suggest that you contact Gene Simmons or someone and put your proposition to him. It's perfectly timely. However, I think it's also true to point out that the type of instrumentation that has been developed for this program is extremely versatile, and I should be amazed if the people who are not in it already will not retool at a phenomenal rate, not retool, that's probably the wrong word, rearrange their type of experimentation so that it does derive the type of information that you want.
The use of the equipment at all, and I'd like to argue this point. I think it's very important because thousands have been spent on this. The instrumentation that has been developed is superb. I am not degrading this at all, believe me. I think it's absolutely spectacular. But the point is, can you apply this technique to the solution of the problem at hand? My feeling is no. I don't think it's what we need. And I think that if the equipment were now applied to other more pressing and useful problems in terms of what the equipment could do, you'd be a lot better off. Now, as far as making what almost appeared to be a personal attack on me for not having applied for sample, because this is the way I have to take it, I'd like to qualify your discussion. I understand, I realize what was going on. And I'd like to qualify your point. And that is, I have been working with Dr. Panaparuma. Perhaps you've forgotten. I was one of the 18 co-authors this morning. But the other point is that we can't do any work unless we get enough sample to work with. And so if we don't have the proper amount of sample, nothing's going to be done. Perhaps we need a little more strength on the LESAPT? Is that what you call it?
As a speaker this morning, was privileged to have Dr. Breger as a co-author and one who worked with me over the last few months. Maybe I'd like to ask Irving right here, you know, in this panel, to suggest the kind of thing that needs to be done. We've gone over this over and over again, and this might be a point really to bring up at this time. I know the discussions we've had in private, and is Irving willing to say something on that?
I've probably walked out of here without a friend in the house. I hope it won't be that way. Actually, my feeling is, as I pointed out, that we have to assume that we're looking for not how the carbon got there, or some premise as to why there's so little at the point. But let's first start out and find out what the forms of the carbon are, both organic, carbide, anything else. These have to be determined first, and this has not been done. We know a lot of things that are not there, but we still have approximately 160 parts per million of carbon, of which only a small or relatively small part has been established as to form. Now, it seems to me, and I asked this question at the GSA meeting in Atlantic City, too, and got no answer that I thought was proper. It seems to me that we should learn something from what we've done. And if it requires this learning experience from what has been reported here today to make changes before we start working on the Apollo 12 and subsequent samples, I certainly think we ought to do that. And I say this, bureaucracy be damned. I think certainly it would be absolutely asinine for us as scientists to go ahead and repeat past mistakes, or repeat work which seems to have, on the basis of what we now know, essentially zero chance of giving us reasonable results, or results which we can make heads or tails of. And so I think, therefore, what I would like to do is seek a survey made of the papers given and the work given today, and decide which types of this work seem to have little possibility of results from here on in, and move them aside, put them in the second category, and keep those programs which seem to have a better possibility of coming up with results on the basis of what we learn in this field. And perhaps in this way, we will also have a little more sample to deal with, and therefore a better chance even then to get reasonable results. Now, of course, I know that this is not going to make some people very happy, but they have had their try at it. They do have their machines, they've done the engineering, and they can still use these for other things.
Well, are you suggesting that mass spectrometry is one of the things that should be dropped from the list of tools? Well, I think as far as to answer my own personal point of view, that we were confident that we accounted for a major part of the carbon, and we have some idea what the form of it was. Oh, that's not correct. One part per million volatilizable material. It was 5 parts per million total volatilizable material. That was what we reported in Science. It means it's mostly contamination. And most of... Pardon? I don't think you've looked at the data. I guess you haven't looked at the data.
I think, Dr. Baker, if you wouldn't mind, could we move to something else? I think you've made a very strong point, and I would like to hear more about it. But, yes, I would like to hear.
May I put a question? Perhaps Don Flory could answer it the quickest. What is the total amount in grams that was distributed, say, to organic interested people, roughly, ballpark number?
I think something like 2 kilograms, probably.
Thank you.
No? More like a kilogram.
I don't feel quite as disheartened as some of the people here, because they did generally find some other interesting results which haven't been confirmed, mainly because some investigators were able to show, say, the presence of amino acids in a sample and didn't have enough to confirm it by some second or other technique. And now, as an interested person in this area, it seems to me that many of us would be interested to work on Apollo 11 samples, even now, if we could all, the people interested in a certain area, would get the same sample, and then we could cross-check our results by different techniques. None of us got enough to do that ourselves, and I wonder whether it wouldn't be beneficial to all of us, before we get into Apollo 12, where there's so little organic matter in there anyway, whether we shouldn't go back and at least check some of our techniques this way.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion, and we might work out a method for homogenizing a fairly substantial amount of sample and then go through a splitting procedure and divide that sample up. We could do that for 11 sample and also for 12 sample, if you feel that that's a worthwhile thing to do.
Well, back to the part of the organic carbon and so on, in the report given by Dr. Ponamparuma this morning and in our gas liquid chromatography of the derivatizable organic, let's say organosiloxanes, that could be as high as 40 to 50 parts per million. And again, we don't know the response factors. If those response factors are different, it could be considerably higher than that. And therefore, it may or may not be a great amount of the carbon has been accounted for.
I think I'd better draw it to a close now because I think another session is due to begin. Thank you very much for the comments, and now we can perhaps have lunch.